Good evening, everyone. Thank you for having us. I love coming to little meetings and having the chance to share some thoughts, basically. When I first got asked, oh, could you come to Hyde Park and do some talks, I asked sort of, well, what do you want me to talk about? Because I guess there's a lot to choose from. And I think it was Barge said that the general themes you were going for was choices. And I think this year, especially, or over the last little bit, that theme has just become something for me, which is like becoming more and more important. Like, there's so much, I guess, that I feel like I have to choose every single day. And it's not even related to my life as a believer or my walk. It's related to all of these, you know, different political things happening and different opinions on social media and different conversations you have with workmates or with your peers or anyone. And it just becomes really hard to know what a good choice is to make. You know, when do we make the right choice, or when do we not make a good choice? So I was pretty stoked, I guess, to have a look at Phineas, who I've been a fan of for a while now, in particular with that point of view, as we're going to have a look at the choice that he made. And essentially, I think Phineas made two incredible choices. We're going to look at one tonight, which we read, and it's a pretty extreme chapter. You read through it and it's like, whoa, like there's a lot going on. But we're going to look at that tonight, and then I think the second night we're going to look at another incident where Phineas chooses to listen. So the two kind of aspects we'll be looking at is Phineas choosing to act, and the second night Phineas choosing to listen. I was gonna do like a bit more slides, but I don't know, the Olympics are very distracting and you do run out of time a little bit. So we're just going simple with the slides, and hopefully I can like really keep you captivated just by how I talk. So Phineas, I mean, the first thing is, who is he? There's a couple of Phineases in the Bible. There's Phineas, Hophni and Phineas. This is a different guy. This is, as we read, it's the grandson of Aaron and the son of Eleazar. So he's of a priestly lineage. And he appears in the Bible a number of times. Here, of course, in Numbers 25 and later on in Numbers in chapter 31. He appears in Joshua 22, which we'll look at next time. And his name comes up in Judges 20, verse 28, where it talks about him standing before the ark. And this is after sort of how he sets himself up here in Numbers 25. And Psalm 106, which is a really great little one to note down somewhere there in your Bible in Numbers 25. Psalm 106, verse 28 to 31. And God's talking about the whole picture of Israel's rebellion throughout the wilderness. It says, summarizing, I guess, the events here in Numbers 25, they yoked themselves unto Baal Peor and ate sacrifice offered to lifeless gods. They aroused God's anger by their wicked deeds, and a plague broke out among them. And it says, but Phineas, he stood up and intervened, and the plague was stayed. And this was credited to him as righteousness. So there's an incredible aspect of character that we're going to be looking at tonight in this man Phineas. And this is sort of right at the end of the wilderness wanderings. So Phineas has grown up from a little fella, and he's seen all of these events, all of the rebellion. He's seen all sorts of things, I guess, happen before him, and different wars and battles and different people that have mixed in and things like that. And this comes right to the end of the wilderness wanderings. And I think, I mean, I don't know, but I would assume that most of us would have had heard of Phineas, or, I mean, it's a pretty extreme story, quite a memorable one. We would probably all have some you know, image him in our mind of the zeal of Phineas and the things that he did, and particularly from this chapter. Some of the other things, when I started looking at Phineas, I was like, man, this guy's got so much more going on as well. So, yeah, he is a big character. But the context of what happens here in chapter 25, just flick back up the pages. Like I said, it's right at the end of the wanderings, and in chapter 22, verse 1, it says that the children of Israel set forward and pitched in the plains of Moab on this side of the Jordan by Jericho. And so that they pitched in the plains of Moab, and this was talked about quite a lot as a time to remember. This was really a time that they were to really be remembering all that God had done for them, the whole journey that they had been pulled through to now being right at the gateway to crossing into the promised land. But there's this scenario, I guess, leading up to the chapter we read tonight, where Balak, the king of the Midianites, Moabites, I think, get them mixed up a bit sometimes, but anyway, he sends messengers to Balaam. And, I mean, you could spend a whole lot of time, I guess, looking at Balaam and things like that, but we don't have all night, probably lucky, because I would keep going and going. But pretty much reading through the chapters, when you look at this guy Balaam, it's hard to tell, you know, where he's at, where he stands, because he's having these interactions with God. And I found it, as I read through them, it's sort of like, what is this guy's deal? Like, what's his point? What's he trying to do here? Well, Numbers 31, verse 16, it tells us, and this is, I guess, in hindsight of the events here in Numbers 25, when he's talking about the influence of the Moabite women, he says, "Behold, these caused the children of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to commit trespass." And also, if you've taken any notes, another one is in Revelation 2, verse 14. And John's writing to the ecclesia in Pergamos there, and he says, "Nevertheless, I have a few things against you. There are some among you who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin." Now, the interesting thing, I guess, about leading into this situation with Phineas is that Balaam has been asked by Balak, you know, go and curse this nation. Like, I've heard what they did to the Amorites and to these other nations, and he's a little bit tedious of them, a bit worried about them. So he seeks the counsel of Balaam to go and curse them. And Balaam basically just speaks truth and speaks the words of God. But the thing is, those two verses, when you look at what this counsel of Balaam was actually all about, you realise that, well, Balaam's speaking God's words, and you can see that when you read through those chapters prior to Numbers 25, but he doesn't believe them. And I don't think he actually even wants them to be the case. So Balaam's kind of giving this advice, but and I think it comes down to his saying, look, I can't curse them, because I'm telling you the truth here about what God thinks, but I'm going to tell you how you can corrupt them. So pretty much this whole situation here in verse 1, as Israel abode in Shittim and the people begin to commit whoredom, it's like there's this influence that's come about from the work Balaam did with Balak, where he could kind of manipulate the situation and bring Israel to a state where they would be judged by God, because they have committed immoralities. So it's just a funny thing that they get to this point through this manipulative man, Balaam. I think it's interesting, because I actually thought, well, Balaam, he must have understood enough about Israel to know that these are people who are in a covenant relationship with God. You know, you can look through Deuteronomy and God's words to them, like, you're my special and chosen people and I'm going to form a relationship with you, and, you know, I don't want you to mix with these nations around you. I want your relationship to be wholeheartedly with me. And I think Balaam, he knows the nation. He knows about that covenant relationship, but he's manipulating it. It's just an interesting point that we get to here at the start of chapter 25. Interestingly, I guess, at the very end of chapter 24, it says Balaam went to his place, and in the King James margin there's a link to Acts 1 verse 25 where it talks about Judas going to his own place, and there's maybe a little parallel in the actions of Balaam and the actions of Judas. But we find the nation there settled in the plains of Shittim, the last station before crossing the Jordan. And like I said, they're at the end of that 40 years. And it's worth, I reckon, noting a quote that we'll probably go to at the end of tonight in Micah 6, verse 5, where it says, Micah's speaking to the nation and he's wanting them to remember. It says, "O my people, remember now Balak, king of Moab, consulted, and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him, from Shittim unto Gilgal, that you may know the righteousness of God." And in Micah's prophecy, he's encouraging remembrance, and it's particularly of these events before crossing the Jordan to Gilgal. I want to sort of keep that in mind because it will come up again. So the men of Israel are sleeping with the daughters of Moab. We read that this morning. And they're forsaking God, and they're forsaking the covenant relationship God wanted with them. If you just turn over to Exodus chapter 34, because it's here that God actually says, you know, I want separation. I want you to be careful of those nations around you. Exodus 34. I always have this habit of turning it up, even though it's like written on my page. Make sure I get it right at least. Exodus 34:15. It says there, or from verse 14, "For thou shalt worship no other god, for the Lord whose name is jealous is a jealous God, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go a-whoring after their gods and do sacrifice to their gods, and one call thee and thou eat of his sacrifice." So there's a lot of warning. There's a lot of warning that God gives to the nation throughout the whole of their wilderness wanderings to be separate. And that's, I just find it so crazy that they're right at the end of this wandering in the wilderness. And again, we're finding themselves caught up in this situation of mixing with the nations around them. And I just thought it's interesting, if you look at the words there, it actually is like a marriage-type relationship, because it says at the end of verse 1, the daughters of Moab, and at the start of verse 3, that Israel joined himself unto Baal Peor. So it's really highlighting that there's this marriage-type relationship between the daughters of Moab and Israel joining himself. And so, of course, the jealousy of God that we read in Exodus 34 is naturally being provoked, because he's looking at this situation thinking, this is the relationship that I've said I want with you and I'll cherish with you, and once again, your focus is going off to other distractions and other gods. And we find that the end of verse 3, the Lord's anger is kindled against Israel. I wanted to pick up, just to, I guess, set up before we keep going on Phinehas, was that they're called to eat. In verse 2 it says that they called the people under the sacrifices of their gods. That's the Moabite people saying, "Here, come. Come and eat with us. Come and sacrifice with us. Come and be with us." They mix in with unbelievers. And so I wanted to pause, I guess, a little bit and just focus here to build up a little bit of a foundation idea, so that then when we look at the actions of Phinehas, I feel like it'll sit better. Because if we brought this to our times, mixing with unbelievers, I think there's a lot of questions that we have. Like, I know I feel a lot of the time so separate from what, you know, you would read in the Old Testament and the nation of Israel, in a sense. I know, you know, ecclesially, that's what we would say, we would represent. But then so much of my time is, you know, out with people that aren't believers. And so I thought, well, what is the principle here? Because separation, it's such a prominent lesson, particularly in the Old Testament. And there's so many Old Testament quotes, Old Testament verses, and the whole of Deuteronomy 7 talks about basically all communion with other nations is forbidden. And funnily enough, Deuteronomy was likely written around about this time as they're about to cross over the Jordan. But the point is, like, the nation, it's not to share, it's not to eat, it's not to hang out, it's not to get comfortable with the other nations because of this influence that they would have on them. And so I thought, well, today when we're faced with, you know, how much do we mix in with people around us who aren't believers? It's an interesting kind of thought or question. And I think it's something that probably confronts us more than we might let on or feel like we're comfortable with to talk about. But it really comes down to choosing and making wise choices. I think one thing that we're really good at as Christadelphians is defining the world and us. And we define that separation quite a lot. It seems that that definition is often taken from the story of Israel. And it might come across that it's an essential part of being Christadelphian, which is true. But I want to put, I guess, a hypothetical question or a hypothetical thought in there into the equation. And that is, do we create a mindset by repeatedly saying something that might in fact be doing us more harm than good by defining the world and us? I mean, I understand the reason behind that, but do we actually in fact create a worse mindset perhaps? Do we become then so internalized that we create an environment where choices don't even need to be made, rather just not have to deal with it? And I think oftentimes that mentality, it comes on as well then as, well, God is black and white, he's absolute, remain separate. That's the lesson. Don't sin and don't hang out with the world, because it's very clear that that's going to just end you in a world of trouble. And then I know, I feel like it's particularly with the story of Phineas that it might be then to the extreme of, oh, and you know what? Be ready to take up that spear if anyone tells you anything other, or if you see anything happening that's not right, or you know, mixing in a little bit too much, that we just need to get out there and crack the whip on that one, or, you know, implant the spear. I thought, well, is this the purpose of the story of Phineas? Is this what we're supposed to be coming away from and thinking, I need to be full of zeal and I need to correct when things in front of me are just wrong? Well, I think there's a certain aspect of truth there. I don't want to take away from just acts. But I think it's very easy as well to miss the point, or to overlook the point, or to just focus too much on one side of what Phineas is about. I thought, you know, what does that approach as the people of God do? And I thought, well, if you look at the law, if you look at the Old Testament, the wanderings in the wilderness, and what they're showing as a whole, what the whole point of the Old Testament really is, it's to just remind us that man is unable. And so I think that we can be better at being in the world, but not of the world. I guess we hear that a lot. Because the reality is, I think, that a lot of us have to go and be friends at work with people that we meet, and to try and gauge how we can both show, you know, good godliness, but also not give ourselves too much that suddenly we're being influenced by them to do wrong. That's a really hard thing for us to figure out. And to be honest, though, the reality is that are the real choices that we make every day. But I think rather than avoiding the world or creating a fellowship which is completely separate from the world, so much so that we might even, within our own group of believers and our brothers and sisters, feel the need to go and hide the reality that the world is in each of us, what we call the world. I think we need to be more honest about that reality. And by creating that environment where we're more open and more honest about that reality of the difficulties we face with those choices every day, we'll create an environment of honesty where we can be more confident to actually move forward, to move on. And just to, I guess, bring that thought into our Bibles, I just wanted to turn over to Romans 7. Again, this is just setting up a little bit of a thought before we really take a close or a brief look at, I guess, Phineas. Romans 7 and verse 1 to 6, it says, "Therefore, my brethren, you also have become dead to the law through the body of Christ, that you may be married to another, to him who was raised from the dead, that we should bear fruit to God. For when we're in the flesh, the sinful passions which were aroused by the law were at work in our members to bear fruit to death. But now we've been delivered from the law, having died to what we were held by, so that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter." If we make this place a place which is only governed by law and rules, and only seeing that side of God, I think we're creating an environment where sin will just continue and will go on and continue to have its grip. Romans is telling us that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit. It's pretty interesting, I think, when you consider the point that we're in, I guess, post-Christ, that we have the ability to look at the lessons of the law and the new way in Jesus Christ. And we have everything, every opportunity in that to do well and to do good. Every opportunity then to, when we meet people who are in the world, to in fact be separate in a way which is almost out of this world. Because it comes from a spirit, it comes from a newness of spirit, where it might not be, I'm only not, you know, with you and I'm only separate from you because I've got to follow this whole list of rules. It becomes, I'm separate from you because I have a love for God and I have a love for the truth and an understanding of God's rules, which means that I actually want to be associated with that. That's a very different mentality to someone who is thinking, I've sort of got to maintain this idea of being separate and not eating because it's just this whole bunch of rules that people at my church tell me to do. I think I'm going to do it. It's a little bit of reading, but just come over to 1 Corinthians because, it does a better job, I think, than I'm going to do of just maybe breaking down some of those ideas. 1 Corinthians 10. Verse 1 says, "I don't want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud and they passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them, and their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. And it says, now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Don't be idolaters, as some of them were. As it's written, the people sat down to eat, to drink, and to indulge in revelry. We should not commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 3,000 of them died. We should not test Christ as some of them did and were killed by snakes. And these are all events that were happening. And again, in verse 11, it says that these were examples. They were written down as warnings for us. And it says, and this is, I think, an incredible bit of the Bible, on whom the culmination of the ages has come. This is, we have everything working in our favour. The Old Testament, the words of Jesus, the example of Christ, and his atonement. But it says, so if you think you're standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. And of course, that's the warning. But it also comforts us by saying, no temptation has overtaken you except what's common to mankind. And God is faithful. He won't let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you're tempted, he'll provide a way out so you can endure it. You know, if you applied that to our interactions with people around us, I think be brave, be confident in your faith and your belief. Because like I said, separation is clearer than just a rule. It's something within us. And God will not put us in a situation that we won't be able to manage. I think that can be taken as a comfort. The chapter actually goes on a little bit, and it's got some other pretty interesting thoughts about literally eating with your brothers and sisters and things offered to idols. But one of the sections that I really liked at the end, and it's talking about the freedom, the believer's freedom, in verse 23, it's this mentality where it's like, I have the right to do anything. You say, sorry, I got that. I read that wrong. It's got to be more like, I have the right to do anything you say. But it says, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but not everything is constructive. No one should seek their own good, but the good of others. Think, yeah, you can have a mentality of I have the right to do whatever I want, but it's seeing that not everything is beneficial and not everything is constructive. So it's this balance, I think, that we're being asked to have. So I guess in summary of that little big side point, is more has been done than just the lessons of the law and just the wilderness wanderings. Of course, we take heed of them and we listen to them, but creating rules and boundaries, it's not the road to successfully secure our salvation, because we're in the culmination of the ages. The culmination of the ages, that's the time period we're in. So I wanted to just set up, I guess, that thought then, as we just briefly now consider the choice that Phineas made in particular to act. The story of Phineas, which we read, it's an incredible lesson, I think, from a man under extreme pressure. And he's in circumstances unlike any of us have probably ever experienced and probably ever will experience. And he, if you flick back to Numbers 25, he's, I guess, summarised by God in verse 11 as being zealous for my sake. And I thought, you know, zeal, that's an incredible thing. It can have a huge influence on the choices we make. And yet maybe at times zeal could get us into trouble. And I thought, if you thought about the story of Phineas as a whole, I think it'd be fair to say that the zeal of Phineas has exercised more influence on Christianity towards violence today than the words of Judas. If you thought about the Dark Ages and the zealots or that went out and they killed anyone who didn't believe. And it was as though that the zeal of Phineas will go and be executed. And it's always been something which I've thought, man, is that taken out of context? Is that taken too far? Has it exercised more influence than even the words of Jesus? Who, and we know Jesus told Peter when he took up the sword, Peter, live by the sword and you'll die by the sword. So there's this funny balance, I think, when we're looking at the Old Testament to then be, balanced out with the words of Jesus, and I think that's important. So Phineas's actions are, I think we need to see them as very specific to the circumstances he finds himself in. Because we've got these two characters who are, there's quite a bit of detail on them. Zimri, the son of Salu, a prince, he goes into a tent with a Midianite woman. And later on in the chapter, we're told that that woman's name was Cosby, the daughter of Zer, a princess. And if you're looking for name meanings, Zimri means a wild goat, which would kind of be annoying if you're a girl and that was the name of the meaning of your name. I'd feel let down. And Cosby means deceitful, which, I don't know, they're probably not great name meanings. I don't know what Jesse means. I should look it up. Hopefully something nice. So I guess you're thinking, okay, well, what's happening here with these two? What's the deal with what's going on here? And there, I guess there's two suggestions I'm going to put forward. One, as simple as they were sexually immoral, that there's this shameless act of defiance, basically sticking it to the people. They go and do it. They walk in front of the side of the whole congregation and in the sight of Moses. It's actually, I guess, an interesting thought that Moses himself was married to a Midianite woman. And so I think, you know, I guess get a bit carried away with like all of the Hebrew and things like that, but I think there's a fair point to be made that it's likely that Cosby was a prophetess, a Midianite prophetess, an influential person, especially in the Midianite, because she was, of a high house and had a high estate. And she had set up a Midianite tent, and it's the word quabba, which I assume I'm pronouncing it right, but the idea behind these quabbas that these Midianite prophetesses set up was that people would come there and they would seek counsel. So I think, whatever's going on here with the obviously decline of the nation, you then get to this instance where one person is making this defiant stand. And whether it's just the fact that he was going to have sex with her in a tent, or there was this second level of basically apostasy going on here. And if you think about the scenario leading up to this chapter, you've got Balaam, a prophet, looking to try and have control and manipulate the situation, and there's a Midianite king who's going to a man to try and get him to curse the nation. And it's almost as though you've got an Israelite man himself going to a Midianite woman, seeking counsel in her tent to work out how we're going to stop this plague that's running rampant. You know, Moses, God has already commanded the leaders of the people, take responsibility here. I want you to take the heads of the people and hang them up before the Lord. Slay everyone, his man, that are joined unto Baal Peor. God's asking responsibility to be taken. And in the face of that, in the face of the plague, this man has stood up and defied God. And I think it's on a level where it's actually saying, I'm not interested even in how God can help us get out of this situation. I'm going to just go and talk to this woman and be with this woman and have a relationship with this woman, and I'll find the solution there. A writer that I was looking through, he said Zimri's crime was not just that he had sexual relations with her in one way or another, but that he installed her in a quabba next to his tent, possibly engaging her as a diviner, in an attempt to find the means of placating the deity responsible for this plague. And here's Phineas, and he's offended at that usurpation of his priestly right. Because we know that Phineas was the grandson of Aaron, son of Eleazar. He's of this priestly family. You know, what's, I guess, interesting is that God had asked, specifically in Malachi 2, verse 7, where he says, "The lips of a priest ought to preserve knowledge because he's the messenger of the Lord Almighty and people seek instruction from his mouth." So that's the responsibility of a priest. And I think the zeal of Phineas in this chapter, it was going to be the counter to the jealousy of God, because Phineas has stronger feelings. He has strong feelings still for his relationship with God, and he saw what was happening in front of him, and he knew that he had to act on what was right. And I think Phineas, in his extreme circumstance, which is very particular to him, he takes his priestly right and responsibility to lead the people away from apostasy and from immorality. And as we know and we read, God gives him a covenant of peace, an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God. It's actually interesting, in the margin, the Hebrew is "with my zeal." So there's a godly zeal that's motivated Phineas to do what he's done. You know, I think it's kind of stood out for me for a long time, and I wouldn't say I've like found an answer, that Phineas's actions are very extreme. And as you're trying to sort of take from that a lesson and apply it to yourself today, I think, like I've mentioned, it's more dangerous to take that on too much. Like, obviously, we're not like running around with literal spears, but I think there's other spears that we can pretty well throw and rear up. And I think that's a very difficult choice for us to make, as to, well, how do we deal with brothers and sisters, with peers, with our friends? But I think the point is, from the example of Phineas, is that he absolutely understood the circumstances that were in front of him. And I think it's important for us to realise that those circumstances are not circumstances we face. So what is the principle? The principle was that he knew what was right and that he stood for what was right. And so I think it just becomes incredibly important then for us to make sure that we have a strong zeal inside of us to know what God wants, what he has said is right. And as I said at the very beginning, we're in this world at the moment that makes it really tough to know what choice to make. And you make a choice and it aligns you with something. It's really hard. And even to the extent that, you know, we might think like choice is suddenly becoming this thing that we might be wondering if we even have it. Like, I just think it's an incredible thing. But what I've taken from this story of Phineas is that it's just important to focus in and to remember the things that God wants us to place importance on. God wanted importance to be placed on him being the one that could bring Israel out of this plague. out of the situation that they'd got themselves in, he wanted to be the one that would be able to bring them out of that. At the door of the tent, they're crying. All of the people are there at the door of the tent crying. But he needs someone to take responsibility. And it's, I think, because of that, because of the fact that Phineas took responsibility, that God gives him this covenant of peace. So I truly believe that we're in a time now where the Spirit of God can most work to bring us to perfection. I believe so firmly that the Spirit of God, the things that we know in the atonement that Jesus has created for us, that the opportunity is there for us to make the choice to take zealous and extreme action for God. And that might only be as much as standing for something we know is right. We don't have these circumstances so much, but the principle still stands. And, you know, I thought, well, what could you summarise for us, I guess, is something that we can take on board. And I thought, well, you know what, Galatians 5, if you turn over to Galatians 5, and it focuses in on the principle, I guess, that comes from the story of Phineas in his choice to act on what he knew was right. And in Galatians 5, I think that's where we can find the application for us. We'll go from verse 16. It says, "This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you will not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary the one to the other, so that you cannot do the things that you would. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. The works of the flesh are manifest in these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murder, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, of the which I tell you before, as I've also told you in time past, that they which do such things don't inherit the kingdom of God." And it says, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. You know, I think we know what to do in terms of what is right. We don't necessarily have to take up any literal spear to, take down those who might be doing wrong. I think when it talks about the culmination of the ages, the lessons that we have of the Old Testament, things like the stories of Phineas and the example of Christ, we have this perfect balance. This perfect balance where we can be wise, where we can treat people with gentleness and self-control, where we can teach people with love and joy and peace. And I think that shines through, because I think even if it came to the point where we're in this situation where we felt like we had to tell a brother or a sister or a peer that maybe what they are doing was wrong, that if you have that character and that spirit in you, it's going to have such a positive effect on them. You know, the story of Phineas, I think it leaves a lot to be contemplated. And if anything, tonight, I hope that I haven't just left you with 1,000 questions, but I hope that it's left you with some thoughts. Because I mentioned Micah 6 at the start, where it talked about the children of Israel. And I quoted from Micah 6, and I just want to finish on that quote, I guess. So it's worth maybe turning to that, Micah 6. starting at verse 4. My people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, plotted, and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered. Remember your journey from Shittim to Gilgal. Remember that time, that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings and with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? And this last verse, he says, he's shown you, O mortal, what is good. What does the Lord require of you? And I think this summarizes the action, the choice that Phinehas made to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And you know what? I think next time when we come to look at this other example of Phinehas, I think you just see in his character as a whole this fine balance of godly zeal, one who's ready to act justly, one who's ready to love mercy, one who's ready to walk humbly with his God. And so we'll leave it there, and next time we come together, we'll be looking at Phinehas' choice to listen.